This is Ed Dabrowski. I am the NERC Standards Development Coordinator for Project 2010-11, known as TPL Table 1, or more popularly as Footnote B. And I want to welcome everybody to the web part of this conference today. We'll be getting started with the presentations in just a moment. I do want to mention that it appears that the web portion of the conference, you might see a little bit of the delay as we go through the slides. It doesn't appear to be anything we can do about that. That's just the bandwidth and connections that we've got. Bear with us on that. All the presentations will be posted following the conference. They'll be up on this project's website on the NERC Standards Development page. And I've got my computer in complete share mode, so you're going to see everything that I put up there, including the chat log. And when we get to the portion of the program where we're going to be taking questions, those of you on the computers will be doing that through the chat log. And those of you who are just on the telephone will do it through the operator on the line, James, who will take care of you. I'm going to turn the mic over right now to John Odom from FRCC, who is chair of the standards drafting team, for a welcome remark.
Yes, well, thank you, everyone. And I want to welcome the speakers, those of you that are here in person, and also those on the WebEx. I want to first thank all the speakers and FERC staff for their attendance here today. This issue is one that the drafting team has been working on for a long time. It started as a part of the Assess Transmission Future Needs, the ATFN Standards Drafting Team, project number 2006-02. We fondly refer to it as the TPL Standards Drafting Team, but the official name is the Assess Transmission Future Needs. That project is revamping all of the TPL standards, TPL 001 through 004. The standards drafting team has been working on this project almost nonstop since December of 06. In the first three postings that we had of the proposed TPL 001, the standard drafting team proposed the most restrictive interpretation of the FERC order with respect to footnote B. That is, the drafting team said you could not drop load or any single contingency. And we had, all during those postings, we received comments back from the industry that the drafting team was too restrictive. That was a tool that the planners needed to have. With the initial ballot, the SDT posted an interpretation that of this project that the SDT thought would meet the FERC order, and that the standard drafting team thought that the industry could support. I'm sorry, that was with the original posting. And as most of you know, the vote on that was overwhelmingly negative. I think we had 34% positive vote out of the 67% that we needed. We had the March 18th order come out, and that's where this project was created. We created a separate project that was 2010-11 just for footnote B. So this team posted that with a something we thought that the industry could support, and it failed. We've recently posted draft 5 of the TPL 001 complete project, but we've deferred the footnote B portion of that in that posting. We said that's going to be resolved under this this project 2010-11. The goal here today is for the drafting team to get feedback both from FERC staff and the industry. The drafting team has got 2 days of meeting scheduled immediately after this, where we're going to use what we get today to have further debate about what is the appropriate language for footnote B, and more importantly, the concept of, is there a way that we can make footnote B restrictive enough to where it doesn't become the rule but becomes the exception. And that's going to happen immediately after this meeting in the next 2 days with the drafting team, with the hope and the plan for a second posting with another ballot of 2010-11 project. That the first time we posted that project, we were close to the required amount to approve footnote B, but we fell slightly short of that. So that's my opening remarks and the SDT overview. And I probably kind of got a little out of order because we probably should do the antitrust guidelines, and then I'll go through the agenda.
All right. Just to remind everybody, this is a NERC meeting, so we are under the NERC antitrust compliance guidelines, and as is our rules, I'm going to read the beginning of this out. Hopefully you all see it on your screen. It is NERC's policy and practice to obey the antitrust laws and to avoid all conduct that unreasonably restrains competition. This policy requires the avoidance of any conduct that violates or that might appear to violate the antitrust laws. Among other things, the antitrust laws forbid any agreement between or among competitors regarding prices, availability of service, product design, terms of sale, division of markets, allocation of customers, or any other activity that unreasonably restrains competition. It is the responsibility of every NERC participant and employee who may in any way affect NERC's compliance with the antitrust laws to carry out this commitment. And I'm not going to read the rest of this. Most of you are probably very familiar with them. I do want to mention to people that this conference is being transcribed. That transcription will be posted on the project website when it's available. So everything you say, either on the mic or through the chat log, is going to be recorded. And with that, I'll turn it back over to John.
Thank you, Ed. So today we're going to start with the FERC staff overview. Bob Snow and Jonathan First from FERC staff are going to give us their perspective of the orders and provide us some guidance and some framework as far as how FERC staff is looking at this issue. And then we're going to have presentations by five speakers: John Bueller of New York ISO, Chuck Matthews of BPA, Ed Ernst of Duke Energy, and Frank Gaffney from Florida Municipal Power Agency, and Kim Jones from the North Carolina Utility Commission staff. After those presentations, we've asked the speakers to make between 10 and 15 minutes of prepared remarks based on the four questions that were posted. After that, we're going to have a Q&A session. The way we're going to handle that is I'm going to ask if the drafting team has questions or comments about something that the speaker said, and then particularly questions for the speakers, and then we're going to open it up to either the chat and the via phone. If you're on the WebEx, you can only ask questions via chat, and we'll queue those up. If you're on the phone, we'll have a moderator go through and try to make sure that that we get those in an orderly fashion. And then when we do the Q&A, I wanted to try to make sure that that you know that you can either ask a question of the speaker for a clarification, or want to make sure that everybody, and those in the audience here live and also those on the WebEx, know that the purpose of this conference today is to hear from you. It doesn't really help us much if we've got, you know, over 150 people on the phone if we don't know what you're thinking. So we're asking you if you agree with a particular perspective, say that, or if you disagree, say that. And so we've got all day set aside here to try to go through this. So then after the Q&A, I'll go through the next steps very quickly, and then we'll adjourn for the day. Hopefully we're going to have active participation. Yeah, so with that, I think we'll just go ahead and get started. We'll ask John Bueller of, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead, Bob Snow of PERC staff to prepare or to give his opening remarks.
Thank you, John. While Ed's getting that, is it everything up there, John? Okay. Thank you, John. Good morning, both people here in the room as well as on the WebEx telephone. My name is Bob Snow. I'm staff in the Office of Electric Reliability at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I'd like to point your attention to the bottom part of this slide, which is probably the most important thing on this slide. I do, and as the people in the room are smirking, I usually say this at every activity. I'm staff. I do not represent, do not speak for the commission or any of the commissioners. What you're about to hear is been vetted within OER, Office of Electric Reliability, but is that of staff, nothing else. I've also tried to make this presentation aimed at a technical audience. My understanding from Ed is that a lot of the people signed up here are in fact technical, so I'm going to try to use things that I would not you not normally see in an order or other things, such as one lines, to make sure we're not talking past each other. Next slide, please. As John identified in his opening remarks, this is one of a number of things this drafting team is doing. A review of the entire TPL series is a very, very large project. This is one important but relatively small aspect of all of those. So in this slide, we're looking at the kind of some of the background information, very focused on, from an engineering point of view, very focused on the Table 1 footnote B. But to put it in that context, you know, the planning standards are essentially in the planning time frame, 1 year out to however long you need to make sure your facilities are constructed on time. And their goal is to take an estimate of what the forecasted firm load is for each of those years, high, low, whatever it might be, some critical system conditions, and the contingencies, and come up with certain criteria, again, all defined in that process. What we're really kind of looking at is a study of what we've called the bulk electric system, and the definition of reliable operation, as well as the requirements in the standards. So you want to keep those facilities, those bulk electric facilities, within their applicable ratings, the thermal voltage or stability rating. Reliable operation says you want to do that to avoid, and I've used the shorthand here, the evil three, which the team has talked about as cascading, uncontrolled separation, and instability. You never want to get that far. Some other discussions, firm transmission service is a glossary-defined term in the commission-approved standards, which is the highest quality of service with no intended or planned, no planned interruptions. Or, and essentially, a single contingency would be the one of the things we won't be looking at. We had some guidance back from the ERO, NERC, in terms of the preliminary staff assessment, and on the slide is the direct quote from that, at least the opinion at that point in time. The commission wanted also clarified that a case-by-case exceptions may very well be an appropriate outcome of this process, that while the exception wouldn't swallow the rule, it wouldn't be the exception being the predominant aspect, there are possibilities for case-by-case exceptions. Next slide, please. And I want to make it very clear, because there have been some confusion in other forums, that when we're talking about real-time operation, you know, an operator is sitting, he or she is sitting at the desk, and this is something occurs to them, occurs on the system. That hopefully they hadn't been planned, things that they planned for should be, they'd be within their capability of taking care of. But there are going to be a time, I think this team has talked about the tornadoes running through and taking out, you know, half a dozen transmission lines that are key to activity. There are going to be times where the operator not only should shed load, they must shed load. It's their option of last resort, not the first resort. It's not the first thing they do when something goes bad on a clear, beautiful clear blue sky day, but something that could happen. Our discussion here is really in the planning time frame, 1 year or more from real time. And in the planning time frame, there are a couple more options that one has, especially if one is looking at a problem that you postulate will occur, you know, 8 years from today. Well, there's a bunch of time to do things. In the order, and I put the citations in parentheses there so you can read and understand a little more. This is PowerPoint slides, bullets that are intended to be summaries. So based on the record and the planning time frame, you shouldn't allow a corrective plan, that would shed load to avoid an overload of a bulk electric system facility. I want to make that a key point. And the examples will get there a little further. We're looking at impacts on bulk electric system facilities that after the single contingency, that those facilities would be overloaded. In the planning time frame, in the simulations that are done, that's basically just the physics. You're calculating what's happening. It exceeds some rating that the planner has put in the program. You're over a voltage, outside a voltage range, or over a applicable, probably short time, thermal rating, or beyond a stability limit. And to solve that, your corrective plan is to have an operating procedure or an SPS or some way that load is, that firm transmission services stopped. Physically, you do that by shedding load. Now, we want to be very careful in that demand-side management, non-firm transfers, are one type of corrective plan that one might use. Maybe not necessarily the only one, but certainly one of them. And the commission clarifies that again, a case-by-case basis might be an appropriate thing. Next slide, please. This is getting down to a one line. This is a kind of a simplified spot on the system, a load that's tapped off a substation, fed by two transmission lines with circuit breakers both locally at the substation and remotely. It's similar to the one that NERC talked about in their comments to the staff assessment. I say similar. In the NERC comments, they did not have circuit breakers at the station, so that if you have the fault on the line, that little red thing on the left-hand side, that design, what NERC was commenting on in comments to the staff assessment, would trip both the left and the right-hand line and the bus itself. They were all in the same protective zone, if I can use that terminology here. In that case, since the load would be served by the protective zone involved, the faulted area, this would be consequential load loss as defined in the NERC comments. But I'm not talking about that. I want to use that as an example. Here we're looking at two separate protective zones. On the left-hand side, there's a fault on the line. The breaker at the station, the 230 kV breaker at the station opens. The other breaker or breakers within the BES system on the left open. And in this case, when the planner runs the simulation with the projected load at that point, projected firm transmission service to that point, the voltage at that point becomes unacceptably low. That's simply the PSSE, PSLF, whichever tool one's using, will have that come out. At this point, the planner, that comes out as an exception in the report, that, okay, I need to do something. Looking at the details, looking at how far off it was, one corrective plan might be to look at where the generators are on the right-hand side and change the voltage schedule of the generator that may very well avoid the problem. There might be enough room to do that. Another possible plan would be correct the power factor at the bus, put a cap bank there, keep the voltage up. A third one might be to use demand-side management or interruptible on the other one. What we're kind of carefully saying is the one you should not use for this single contingency is to curtail firm transmission service to the point that I show on that point, that arrow there. That to curtail, to plan to curtail that service to solve a voltage problem on a BES element should not be used, is the staff's position. And I think that was the clarification that the commission was looking for in the March 18th. That was the clarification in Order 693, which is long gone. The time frame was in the March 18th order to put a time frame on that clarification. But we very careful. Now, if you do that, if you don't curtail term transmission service, it may have an impact on the power quality issue on the local distribution area. That's not the reason we're doing it. It might be a good outcome, a non-hurting outcome. But the real issue is looking at the BES element, looking at the criteria involved, and because we have to understand we're in planning mode. If the planner never tells the operator anything, nothing happens. Or if the planner never bills anything, nothing happens. That corrective plan is going to tell the operator either if you get in this mode, this is what you do. You can open some breakers or do something else, or you do something, like, or you implement an SPS there, or you, or RAS if you're in the West. Sorry about that. That you basically do that. Okay? Next slide, please. This one's a little more complicated, and maybe a little more typical. There's a through flow of firm transmission service from the left-hand side to the right of 450 megawatts. And we're in planning mode now. So at one point in time, I've got 75 megawatts of load at that station. Looking at a single contingency, the 75 megawatts supplied there and the 450 megawatts firm transmission service equals the rating of the line. Not an issue. Everything's fine. However, the planners are telling me that the that area is going to grow. There's a new factory coming in there or some economic growth or some things that are usually good things. And it's doubling. It's going from 75 to 150 megawatts of firm load at that point. In that case, and the little red one is the 150, in that case, the rating, the loading on the circuit is 600 megawatts for that contingency. Again, there's a couple of things one might do. That 600 megawatt limiting element may very well be 50 feet of wire in a downdrop somewhere, and that the next limiting element after that one is removed is 700 megawatts. So one would basically take, you know, six lengths of wire, some clamps, connectors, and make this a 700 megawatt section for the first part. That may be one option. Another option may be there's a sag limit somewhere. Put some slack on one of the spans. There may be many, many, many options based on whatever the entity has. The two options in this case that I suggest you not use is curtailing either the 450 megawatt firm transmission service from left to right or half of the firm transmission service to that point shown at the things. Again, issue is one is looking at overloads on bulk electric system elements to avoid, and that's the plan here is, the plan you should not be using is to curtail that service. John, next slide. Hey, I'm sorry, you're doing this. Well, you're both doing it. Okay. In summary, you know, suggesting that entities should not plan. Now, I'm very careful. Planning as opposed to real-time operation. We're in a 1 year or more real time. Do not plan to curtail firm transmission service as your plan. But that's an outcome of planning standards have an outcome, and the plan is that outcome. To avoid exceeding thermal voltage or stability limits on any BES element, or all of the things that are covered in the TPL series. All of your projected loads, all your projected critical conditions, all the contingencies that are defined in Table 1, and the criteria that are defined in Table 1. The commission clarified that if you may have a case-by-case exception process. The team doesn't necessarily have to do that, but they may do that. Demand-side manager and interruptible loads are types of acceptable corrective plans in both timeframes, planning or real-time, to exceed any of these things. And load shedding as a last resort. Any operator would only use it as a last resort, or they consider the last resort based on the facts in front of them. In real time, not only should be, but must be done. Right, thank you for your time. I really thank this team for the effort. John mentioned from December of 2006, this team's put in a lot of effort, a lot of time, and I really appreciate all you've done. Thank you. Jonathan?
For those out there on the web, what we had said before was that we were going to hold questions until the end of all the presentations. And we're starting to get a couple of questions here on details of Bob's presentation, and we're not planning on answering them at this time. We're going to wait. So if you want to hold those, it's probably just going to make life easier for everybody when we get to the back end.
Hello, my name is Jonathan First, and I work for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Office of General Counsel. And Commission staff appreciates NERC's holding this technical conference and appreciates being invited to participate and give some remarks. We hope the conference is successful and brings some resolution to the issues regarding reliability standard TPL 002, Table 1, Footnote B. I personally am impressed. I thought only lawyers could hold a whole-day conference on a footnote, but others, so, and engineers just, you know, went up to in esteem in my eyes. Now, that being said, my perspective is that of a lawyer and not of an engineer. My understanding from my engineering colleagues at FERC is that a fundamental point of transmission planning, as Bob was saying, is that the system should be able to withstand a single contingency without load shedding. This is reflected in current TPL 002. Table 1, footnote B, also contains the following language, and I'll quote it. Planned or controlled interruption of electric supply to radio customers or some local network customers connected to or supplied by the faulted element or by the affected area may occur in certain areas without impacting the overall reliability of the interconnected transmission systems. And everybody's aware that's footnote B. This language appears to allow some limited planned load shedding in a single contingency. The NERC comments way back in June of 2006, discussed one scenario, which this is interesting. Until I talked with Bob the other day, I always thought the NERC comments were discussing a possible exception where non-consequential load should be shed. And Bob corrected me and said, no, the scenario in the NERC comments, his understanding is that that's consequential load shed. So I don't know if that's, helpful information or interesting to anybody else, but that was, that was helpful for me. In any case, this language appears to allow some limited planned load shedding in a single contingency, but the limits of this exception are not well defined. In Order Number 693, the Commission directed NERC to clarify footnote B. In doing so, again, the Commission recognized that fundamentally the system should be planned to withstand a single contingency without load shedding. The Commission also allowed NERC to consider the concerns of certain commenters regarding limited planned load shedding, perhaps in the form of a regional difference on a case-specific basis. As we all know, on March 18th, the Commission issued an order setting a compliance deadline for developing the directed clarification of footnote B. This order simply set a compliance deadline, did not change the Order 690C directive or add on to it. In the June 11th order, the Commission denied requests for rehearing of the March 18th order. The Commission also extended the compliance deadline for an extended period and also provided some additional clarification of the Order Number 693 directive. And perhaps most relevant to this conference, the Commission stated in June 11th order, and again I'll quote just sort of an excerpt from paragraph 21, "We believe that a regional difference or a case-specific exception process that can be technically justified to plan the loss of firm service, I quote, the fringes of various systems," which was some language that NERC had used in its brief, "would be an acceptable approach. Thus, the Commission did not dictate a single solution. In any event, NERC must provide a strong technical justification for its proposal." And that's the end of the quote. Now, my understanding is that the purpose of this technical conference today is to discuss possible ways going forward to modify the current footnote B language that would satisfy the Commission and also meet the needs of industry. Now, my main objective in attending the conference today is to listen to what NERC and stakeholders have to say. However, I also want to offer a few thoughts and observations. First, while the issue of an exception to TPL 002 footnote B has received considerable attention, it's not entirely clear to me from my legal perspective what problem we're trying to resolve. I'm interested in the types of scenarios envisioned or currently applied by stakeholders where an exception might be needed for planning for shedding a firm load, non-consequential load in a single contingency. Some others around the room and on the computers might have some ideas, but I'd certainly like to hear that. And that was the first question that NERC teed up in its advertisement for the conference. It seems that the solution that we come up with should consider and address such real-life legitimate scenarios. Otherwise, we may simply be talking past each other. Second, the Commission's June 11th order picked up on language used by NERC in its pleadings regarding the fringes of the system. Now, being an engineer, I'm not sure what the fringes of the system are. Does this refer to the physical ends of the system? Unlikely scenarios identified in the planning process or something else? I think the overall idea is to rein in whatever exception is developed so the exception is not overly broad. As John Odom said, there's some flexibility here, but if the language basically is too broad and basically allows free rein so that the exception swallows the rule, then that's probably going to be problematic from FERC staff point of view. Finally, and perhaps the most important thing, is that whatever solution is developed, it must be objective, clear, unambiguous, so that both regulators and transmission planners understand what circumstances the exceptions would apply in. Now, staff does not speak for the Commission, obviously. However, as the conference proceeds, if participants seek further insight or input from Commission staff regarding what the Commission order said or our reaction to straw man scenarios or proposals, we'll do our best to provide some feedback. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, and also Bob, thank you. Okay, with the FERC staff overview as a backdrop, we've invited the five speakers to give their perspective on footnote B, and so we're just going to jump right into that, and we'll start off with John Bueller from the New York Independent System Operator. John is the Executive Regulatory Policy Advisor for the New York ISO. And so, John, welcome to the conference, and thank you for agreeing to make a presentation.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everyone. Strikes me that we have maybe too many Johns in the room here, but we'll try to deal with that. I am here today representing the ISO RTO Council's Standards Review Committee, who have commented on previous standard drafting team proposals and who have been involved in the process of reviewing and revising this footnote B that's the subject here today, as well as many other NERC activities. I've also run my discussion and comments by the NPCC staff, and they also have endorsed my presentation today as well. I thank Jonathan from FERC for letting me skip through my first two background slides here. So maybe we can go, if we could go to slide three. Well, if we could just to slide three for a moment. Where do we go? I think you're going ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I am not bound exactly as the FERC staff are bound in terms of speaking for the commission. I'm not going to speak for the commission, but I'm going to at least paraphrase comments that I heard from commissioners at the July 6th conference on this issue, or certainly related to this issue. In the opening remarks, Commissioner Spitzer in particular made a point to the assembled group to say that industry participants should not take the March 18th orders on the issue of load curtailment to signify that it was the commission's view that any loss of load was standards reliability violation. That, I think, at least started that whole discussion off on a very positive note, and there was, for those of you that were there, there was considerable discussion on this issue during the conference with respect to both the operating time frame, the planning time frame, and the penalty issue. Well, I'm not going to go into the penalty issue, believe me, today. And I think as a result or in response to the FERC technical conference, you can move to the next slide, NERC indicated that it would take the guidance provided by FERC in the June 11th order and convene this conference here today to try to resolve the issue by the extended timeline that FERC has provided. As John Odom already mentioned earlier, the NERC standards drafting team has been working on this issue for quite some time, and in particular just earlier this year presented a proposal which the Standards Review Committee of the IRC supported in its comments that we filed on May 25th. And I will be referring to those proposed revisions because I think that they can go a long ways towards the objectives that Jonathan Firth just stated in terms of clarifying the requirements and having unambiguous language, and that is the direction that we support. Go on to the next slide, please. Existing footnote B has been referenced and read several times already, so this is just for history. I would like to go to slide six. And I know nobody can read this, but I just want to characterize, and those of you in the room who have had more direct involvement in this than I have, this is the most recent standards drafting team proposed revisions, and they address a number of different issues to clarify or an attempt to clarify that interruption of proposed customer projected customer demand is not allowed with certain exceptions, the first being a radial exception, which I guess you could call a consequential loss, the second being to a facility that may become radial upon the occurrence of a contingency, the third sub-bullet attempting to put some specifics around the conditions under which and the amount of load that may be considered for curtailment to be at a load level greater than 90% of forecasted load, and that the absolute amount of demand to be curtailed shall be no greater than 50 megawatts. Finally, the fourth bullet, as has already been mentioned, the exception being interruptible demand at demand side management, which is contracted specifically to provide such corrective actions and such mitigation in the event that it's needed. And then the paragraph at the end to attempt to provide clarification that load curtailment would not be considered until appropriate redispatch options were exercised, and that's, of course, particularly relevant in the organized market areas where that indeed does happen on a minute-by-minute basis. Go to the next slide. The first question posed for today's conference goes back to the existing language and asks under what circumstances we believe that the existing footnote B would allow an entity to plan to shed non-consequential load. In our view, the existing language, especially those highlighted terms, are very broad and subject to interpretation. And we support, as I said previously, a modification to footnote B similar to, if not most of the proposals that I just went through in the most recent draft language, which provide more specificity in the first place and hopefully lead to that unambiguity that FERC staff indicated it's looking for. Question number two, FERC suggested that planning to shed non-consequential load over a single contingency could be applied at the fringes of the system. And this question asks if this is an appropriate limitation. If FERC counsel doesn't know what fringes is, and he's a lawyer, I'm not quite sure what fringes are either, and I'm an engineer. So we think that this language, while it may have been proposed by a good-meaning entity, again is probably fraught with various interpretations and probably would not be helpful to incorporate into the standards. And again, we look back at I guess it was the third bullet. We purport those proposed revisions that would place a limit on the amount of demand that can be interrupted as a more specific way rather than trying to define what the fringes of the system might be. Question number three, the question was asked if footnote B were restated to prohibit any planned loss of non-consequential load for a single contingency, what might that impact be on a given system? If we were to assume that such a restatement would prohibit special protection schemes from tripping non-consequential load, there would be, we believe, upgrades needed in many ISO and RTO and other regions. In the NPCC region, for example, there are currently existing several special protection schemes that have load rejection for things like undervoltage, the example that Bob gave, his first example, as a matter of fact. But to address Bob Snow's comments about the planning horizon and providing more time to react and so forth, I guess I might observe that a plan indeed is just that. If a plan would include the recognition that a special protection scheme, for example, employing load rejection, as called in the NPCC region, was an appropriate aspect of a plan which ultimately would lead to the building of facilities to remove that special protection scheme, I think that is appropriate, and indeed that has happened in NPCC. A number of special protection schemes employing such load rejection have been retired as the plan intended them to when facilities were put in place, which solved the contingency. So it seems to us that is an appropriate part of a plan to include such measures. Also, if the footnote were restated in such fashion, it may create inconsistencies with planning criteria or local supply reliability, as may be accepted or in fact approved by state or provincial regulatory authorities, and may also result in increased cost to end use customers. And you'll hear more about that from some of the other speakers later in the panel. Going to the last question. This deals with the suggestion by FERC that the exceptions could be handled on a case-by-case basis. The IRC does not support implementation of this type of a process because we feel that it would lead to unequal judgment in various cases. And again, we support a modification to footnote B that moves in the direction of providing more specificity rather than less. One final comment on the last slide. In the comments on the SDT's most recent proposal, the Standards Review Committee did note potential for conflicts with state commissions, which could place utilities to attempt to follow FERC's position, and this would be a prohibition on use of load curtailment on non-consequential load loss in a compromising position. In the U.S., state commissions, which are rate authority, may take the position that interruption of small loads or remote loads may be acceptable in light of the costs for upgrade facilities that would otherwise be needed. And there were notes in some of the previous FERC documents about the economic aspects, if you will, but these are real in a retail jurisdiction. And similar conflicts may also exist in Canadian provinces. And again, we'll hear more about that particular issue from other speakers on the panel here this morning as well. So those are my comments. I'll be happy to participate in discussion later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Now we'll hear from Chuck Matthews. I can find the slide presentation. And Chuck is the Transmission Planning Process Manager for Bonneville Power Administration. So with that, Chuck, I'll turn it over to you.
Hi. I'm Chuck Matthews. I'm an engineer working in transmission planning at the Bonneville Power Administration. As you know, Bonneville Power Administration is a federal power marketing agency in the northwestern part of the United States. Next slide. Background. Other folks have more background than I have listed. This is just a very quick synopsis. Order 693, FERC had directed the ERO to clarify footnote B with regards to planning for loss of non-consequential load for contingencies. FERC order that was issued March 18, 2010, they directed the ERO to submit footnote B modifications by June 30th, and then they subsequent order denying request for rehearing, but granted extension of the deadline. Slide. Of course, for planning purposes, you know, our main focus is meeting NERC standards, WECC criteria, and then VPA also has our internal criteria that we use for guidance. In the BPA criteria, I did want to mention that I developed this slide based on what BPA planning perspective really versus larger perspective, I guess. The BPA criteria basically defines the grid in three segments for planning purposes. We have the main grid, and that's providing primary connections among the major load centers, large generating plants, major interties, intermediate load centers, to basically transferring bulk power across the system, and that's above 300 kV. BPA defines a secondary grid, which connects the main grid to points of delivery and points of interconnection with other utilities that serve load. in the region. And then in the BPA criteria, there's we have radio grid and improved radio grid, which provides service to and connections among specific points of delivery or points of interconnection from the secondary grid. So improved radio is mainly loop service, whereas radial is just radial connection to points. Next slide. So the first question, circumstances under which footnote B allows planned shedding of non-consequential firm load for single contingency. The existing footnote B allows planned or controlled interruption of non-consequential load for some local network customers supplied by the faulted element or the area affected by the faulted element. As referenced above, BPA defines improved radio grid as a substation on a loop where you may not loss of one side, loss of the stronger side of the loop may require some load loss to serve it from the weaker side of the loop. When you get down to the improved radial grid, that's where we would think that that's where the footnote B would apply. So in the BPA system, that's where we would apply that to. Next slide. References to fringes of the system. Again, fringes of the system in BPA, we would basically define that as the radio grid or the improved radio grid, as has been discussed above. We believe it would be appropriate to limit interruption for these types of situations to so it does not really have an impact on the main grid. A couple of points for bulk transfers. We don't really plan the system to shed load for main grid outages. We do plan to try and keep the connectivity to loads based on the criteria. We really apply this to local area load service type issues, trying to serve load in the local area versus the system. Next slide. So other specific criteria could include there's the amount of demand in the area in question, maybe one criteria. The other criteria might be a demonstration of the impact rather than a topographical type of a definition. Basically, in our part of the system, there are smaller points of delivery and load areas that are spread out and served by longer lines. So a one-size-fits-all approach, specific megawatt level, may not work very well, since the weighing the costs and benefits is also dependent on the location. If you have a little bit larger load that's served by a 75- or 100-mile loop, and you have a smaller load that's served on a very short loop, there's a difference in the benefits to doing the cost of providing better service to those loads. The benefits, the cost may be more to serve a larger load that's further away from the system. So a rigorous demonstration approach, we don't believe that provides the reliability benefits that are commensurate with the effort required. The real need for that we believe is to focus on finding the problems in the bulk grid and fixing these problems, some of the changes could focus more on a lot of analysis that are trying to not show problems. Next slide, I guess. No plan, the question three, no planned loss of non-consequential firm load. So, first of all, it's assumed that planned loss of non-consequential firm load is defined as merely a violation of applicable criteria. in studies, it's difficult to determine if you're actually going to lose the load. If a bus goes to 0.94 for a voltage issue, if a bus goes to, say, 0.94 per unit versus a bus going to 0.8 per unit, it's hard to differentiate how much load's going to be lost, I guess. Generally, in BPA system, we're a bulk transmission provider, and we don't really have areas where an event resulting in the loss of a single element results in loss of non-consequential loads in studies. However, this could result in increased requirements and costs to end-use customers, those that are served from BPA. General examples may be to conversion of lines to higher KV, additional circuit breakers for further sectionalizing the system, additional voltage support equipment near points of delivery, shunt caps, et cetera. Next slide. So question four, could it be handled on a case-by-case basis? We think that handling exceptions on a case-by-case basis would be difficult to implement. A process to do that would require criteria developed for allowable impact, some demonstration of impacts to the system. Again, there would be a lot of effort put into proving there's no problem versus finding the real problems and fixing them. An exceptions logging process, that could also be a big process. We do support the footnote B and making changes to the footnote B versus other more complicated approaches for this issue. Footnote B is a tool that helps provide reliability at reasonable cost. And generally in some of the smaller parts of the system, not all load loss is detrimental to system reliability. That's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck. Now we will go to the next speaker, our agenda, which is Ed Ernst. Ed is with Duke Energy, and he's the Director of Transmission Planning. I'll turn it over to Ed now.
Okay, thank you. Well, good morning, folks, and we're glad to have you here in Charlotte today. We've been asked to speak this morning to the four questions, and so I will do that. But before I do, I want to just cover a few slides here in a minute where I want to talk a little bit about kind of how Duke is thinking about this thing in the context of the NERC reliability standards as a whole, and then also share with you our practice on how we apply this footnote B today. So if we can go to slide two now. When we approach this discussion, we step back and we file comments in this whole voting process. And, we go back and look at what we read in the Energy Policy Act, which empowers NERC to establish reliability standards to provide for the reliable operation of the bulk power system. And then that Energy Policy Act goes on to define reliable operation to mean, avoid uncontrolled separation cascading outages. We've all read these words. So, as Duke approaches this, we think the focus of the standards needs to be on those things that go to the reliability of the bulk power, bulk electric system. And we don't think that we need to be getting the NERC standards tied up in issues that we view as reliability of local load when that is not going to have an impact that's undesirable on the bulk electric system. That's kind of where we're coming from. Slide three. Here's footnote B. We've all seen this 18 times. We can move on to slide four. Footnote B, in preparing for this talk, we talked at Duke and we said, how often do we actually use this footnote B? And, the reality is it's used on a very limited basis. In fact, today, as we've scratched our heads, we don't have an application that we're using today. So we really view this as much as something that the planner, as someone said earlier, would have in his toolkit to make those decisions on reliability as he's trading off other issues. You know, we look at limited basis, meaning small amounts of customers, small amounts of megawatts. I can't tell you whether that's 10 or 50 or 100 megawatts. I don't know. But it's small, and that we're using it in a limited number of applications. You know, it is more the exception than the rule. You know, and as we're going through, thinking through issues related to footnote B application, you know, we're looking at, you know, what's the probability that that initiating contingency is actually going to occur? What's the probability that it's going to occur at a load level during the year such that when I do have that contingency, it's actually going to create an overloading issue? And then we're going to weigh that against the impact and cost of the project or improvement that would be needed if we did not have the flexibility of footnote B. So there is that trade-off that's going on in the planner's mind as he's making these trade-offs. Next slide. You know, as to the four questions we were asked to speak to, the first one was around, you know, how do you view footnote B in terms of when it can be used? Well, obviously, based on my prior slide, we would view that it gives us a good bit of discretion to make these trade-offs as long as we continue to meet the performance criteria of Category B, which is no cascading outages, not impacting overall reliability of the bulk power system, and respecting applicable facility ratings. You know, we've included here, I think, one of the speakers from FERC said he was interested in examples. We've included here a couple of hypothetical examples. We've got line A. It's short, doesn't have a lot of exposure, so there's not a lot of exposure to tripping. For a limited number of hours during the year, those peak hours, the tripping of line A due to a fault can cause an overload on line B. Line B just happens to be located in an area that is environmentally and culturally sensitive. And it's also an area where we're not experiencing any significant load growth. So by being able to shed a small amount of load on line B, when the A contingency does occur and causes an overload on B, we eliminate the need for that project on line B. That's kind of the trade-off that's going on here. Another example would be we have an N-1 contingency overload in an auto bank that we can address with shedding of a small amount of load in the area, knowing that several years from now we've got another project on the book, some addition of generation, some transmission improvement that's going to address the issue. So we kind of would view this as something we would use in the interim, once again, looking at the likelihood of its occurrence and the exposure to the number of customers. So those are a couple of hypothetical examples that we would offer up. Next slide. Well, fringes of the system, what does it mean? Good question. You know, when we were putting this slide together the other day, we thought, you know, folks could think about that as someplace remote, out on the edges, in the rural areas, away from the urban load centers. So I think I understand the intent of the comment, but I think it's kind of a difficult and inappropriate concept to hang our hats on. I think a better way to approach this would be, once again, it's a small amount of load, you know, as determined by the transmission planner, taking into consideration that there is going to be stakeholder and customer input through our planning processes, and we're always subject, at least in the jurisdictions that I'm familiar with, to state regulatory review. So so our state regulators can always help us out with these decisions if they're seeing things different. Next slide. If footnote B were restated today, you know, what would it mean to your company? You know, as I said earlier today, we don't have any active applications of the discretion in footnote B. What we do think is that it's important that we keep this footnote B to give us flexibility, a tool in our toolkit, as we like to say. It does give us that tool so that we've got the ability to provide reliable electric service at least cost, which is part of our responsibility to our customers, subject to regulatory and stakeholder review. Last slide, the whole discussion about should we have a case-by-case exception, you know, Duke would not support this. You know, really, we think that, you know, going to the ERO or NERC on something that really has more to do with a local quality of service issue versus something that's impacting the reliability of the bulk power system really is inconsistent with what NERC and the reliability standards are all about. And once again, we think the proper way for those decisions to be made and vetted is in our planning process, knowing that we've got stakeholder review, customer input, we've got regulatory review as well. John, those are my comments. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. Our next speaker is Frank Gaffney. Frank is a regulatory compliance officer for the Florida Municipal Power Agency. With that, Frank, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, John. FMPA of the Florida Municipal Power Agency serves about 17 different municipal utilities in the state of Florida. So I'll be presenting a point of view of the city of Key West down in one of the fringes, the unambiguous fringes of the system. I'll also be talking about FMPA is one of the members of TAPS, the Transmission Access Policy Study Group, which is a trade organization of transmission-dependent utilities. So I'll be presenting two examples today of this issue, essentially. Essentially, our position is that footnote B should not be eliminated, but should be revised to optimize value to the customer. And we have five different key considerations that we offer to the standard drafting team to consider in this revision to footnote B. The first is benefits to the consumer. Is the cost of the upgrade justified? In all honesty, most consumers are fed from radial distribution circuits, radial step-down transformers, and we still allow consequential load loss. So there is some level of risk to the consumer already. Second is, of course, we have to avoid the evil three, as Bob put it. We can't end up with a cascading instability or uncontrolled separation. It can't end up with a discriminatory position of offering transmission service, and I'll describe what that means later. I think a very important component to this is it has to be voluntary to the transmission customer, LSE. We have various levels of firm transmission service, like conditional firm service. This could be a type of conditional firm service. And the last point is it can't be caused by a generator contingency. Right now, the existing TPL standards treat a generator contingency the same as a transmission contingency. And as we know, generator force outages are at least an order of magnitude more frequent and could be two orders of magnitude more frequent than a transmission contingency. So let me go into two examples. Let's skip this slide. And let's do two examples of what these key considerations mean. So first I'll talk about the unambiguous fringe of the system, the Florida Keys. Florida Keys is fed by two parallel 138 kV lines from the mainland in Florida City to Tavernier about, as you can see, a little less than a third of the way down, but let's call it one third of the way down. And then it's radial fed the rest of the distance. You could argue that since both of those parallel lines start and end in the same location, they really are the same thing, and it could be a radial system. But so far, we haven't made that argument stick. The total load in the Keys, well, let's go to the next slide, and let's do some Keys facts. And, yes, the pun is intended. It is the end of the continent, like I said, about two-thirds of the line is fed by a radial line. About two-thirds of the load is actually on that radial line. There's about 300 megawatts of load on the whole Keys. About 200 megawatts is fed from the radial line, being consequential load loss on loss of that line. It's served by two utilities that work very closely together, the Keys and the Florida Keys Electric Co-op. And there's about 100 megawatts of small non-BES generation in the Keys, all oil-burning because there's no gas down there. All have air permit constraints, so they can't run very much. So there's a production simulation, a production cost element to this whole equation as well. Next slide, please. We have an import limit into the Keys. The input, as you can imagine, with a long, stretched-out 138 kV line, there's a voltage stability issue. We have an under-voltage load-shedding scheme that we depend on post-first contingency to maximize the import into the Keys, therefore minimizing the production costs. The use of footnote B, we're able to import about 275 megawatts. So you can see we don't have to run the generation very often. It's a peak load of about 300 megawatts. But without footnote B, the import limit would drop to about 200 megawatts, which means essentially we would have to run the generation all the time. We'd violate our air permits, and essentially it would mean we would have to build something immediately. Next slide, please. I think a key component to this is, what do the consumers expect? The Keys has an island mentality. It wasn't that long ago that the Keys was not connected to the mainland. It wasn't that long ago that the Keys tried to secede from the Union and become a concrete public. There is an expectation that they're going to have some load loss. Two-thirds of the Keys still has a radial line. And the consumers down there, including a large commercial and a Navy base, know this and are prepared for it. There is no impact to the bulk electric system. The Keys does actually experience a loss of the entire system about once every other year. As you can imagine, when you're only fed by two lines, it happens. No one ever hears about it. No one notices. The reliability coordinators, there's no frequency deviations. It's only about 300 megawatts of load, which is only like a third of the size of the largest unit in Florida, so it really doesn't cause a problem. Okay? Next slide, please. What happens if footnote B is eliminated? Well, we'd have to build a third circuit from Florida City to Tavernier. We'd have to put series capacitors down there. We'd have to put a lot of active reactive compensation down there. For ballpark estimate, about $70 million worth of cost with no benefit to the consumer. Because two-thirds of the load is still fed from the radial line, and only those customers are on the existing UVLS system anyways. So there would be no increase, essentially, in customer service. Next slide, please. So if we look at our key, at the five key considerations, are the benefits to the consumer? No, there's no increase in the quality of service, but the customer rates would climb about 10 to 20%. There's no impact to the BES. 300 megawatts of load loss is not sufficient enough to cause anything to happen. Is it discriminatory? Does it impact anyone else's ability to provide transmission service? No, it doesn't. It's a radial system. It doesn't have loop flow impacts anyplace else in the system. Is it voluntary to the transmission customer LSC in the planning horizon? I do stress the planning horizon because, as we all know, in the operating horizon, things happen. You might need to shed load. In this case, the Keys and FKAC are voluntary participants because they understand the benefit to the consumer. And is it for a generation contingency? No, it's on loss of one of the two transmission lines into the system. So this is an example, a clear-cut example, we believe, where footnote B should apply. Let's go on to the next example, which is the opposite side of the story. This is about a transmission-dependent utility in another part of the country. I'm withholding the names to keep people out of the picture. Plus, I don't know the whole story because it's not us. So let's continue. transmission dependent utility buys a portion of a baseload plant. When they bought the portion of the baseload plant, they bought firm point-to-point transmission service to get it to them. And this was decades ago. The transmission provider neighbors another actually larger transmission provider, and there's a significant amount of loop flow. And the TDU has internal higher cost generation. Let's continue. A little bit more background. Next slide. They bought the point-to-point service and the portion of the baseload unit decades ago. But load has grown, and generation has been added to the region without accompanying transmission investment. It's in a non-RTO area. The prevalent flows north to south. There is other must-run generation owned by others near the TDU in the south. So when you lose a must-run generator in the south, it increases north-to-south flow, et cetera, et cetera. For a single transmission contingency, the transmission provider will lose its major tie to the south and depends largely on loop flow through the neighboring provider. Next slide, please. Last summer, this happened in reality. There was a forced outage of a must-run generator. As a result of that single contingency of a generator, the TDU's point-to-point service to its baseload coal plant was curtailed. The TDU had to absorb redispatch costs as a result. And the reliability coordinator warned the TSB, neighboring TSB that had the loop flow, the TDU and neighboring TDUs in the region, that if the worst-case transmission contingency were to occur in addition to loss of the generator, that load would need to be shed. Well, this is the case, next slide, that some key considerations were not met in my list of five, all right? It was for generator contingency. And forced outage of generators, as we know, is far more frequent than transmission contingencies, and it ended up with a curtailment of point-to-point service. It does not benefit the consumer, because the consumer, as opposed to the Keys, where they benefit from reduced production costs, in this case, the consumer experienced higher production costs as a result of this. And it was not voluntary in the planning horizon to the transition customer LSE. Another key point I want to make is, like I said before, the Keys has an island mentality. They kind of expect that level of service. In this case, it's not an island. It's a different part of the system. The expectations are higher, and the firm point-to-point service was bought decades ago, and the service degraded over time. So I think that's another key consideration. Next slide, please. Now, this did not happen in this example, but you do need to ask yourself the question, is there an opportunity for discrimination? We have to assume, since the transmission provider themselves was one that they would have to shed load, that they probably do depend on some level of load shedding to provide themselves firm service. So if a TDU were to request additional firm service, would they be required to do the upgrade to get that service that the transmission provider is avoiding? We are aware of other situations throughout the country as TDUs that this seems to be the case, where transmission providers are avoiding transmission upgrades and then lumping it into the transmission request. So that's an opportunity for discrimination that we'd like to see eliminated. Next slide, please. So to sum up, two summary slides. I was asked the question, next slide, please. How is voluntary different than non-firm? One of the key considerations I mentioned was that it has to be voluntary in the part of the transmission customer LLC. Well, to us, there's multiple levels of firm service. As we all know, and we're doing power supply contracts, you can get various levels of firmness to your power supply contract. We believe that some level of firm, various levels of firm service could be a function of transmission service as well. We're already doing that with conditional firm service. And we already do that, in all honesty, when we say that we can lose consequential load of a radio line. Certainly, at minimum, firm transmission service should not be curtailed for a generator contingency, which happens relatively frequently. I mean, if you assume a 5% force outage rate versus a 0.5, a 0.05 force outage rate for a transmission line. However, it does get more fuzzy when you start thinking about conditional firm service, curtailment post first transmission contingency, like I mentioned, consequential load, or curtailment in preparation for the second contingency. So we think it could be that the transmission provider could offer multiple levels of firmness to the transmission customer. Next slide, please. So bottom line is we believe that footnote B should be retained. It should be modified. It needs to take into account the wise decision-making of transmission providers in providing their load in the most economic and efficient manner possible. Of course, you can't allow cascading instability or uncontrolled separation. You can't allow discriminatory practices. It should be voluntary on the part of the transmission customer, or at least the customer should be offered the cost benefit to their levels of firmness of service, and it should not happen for a generator contingency. In this presentation, I did fail to answer the fourth question. In general, FMPA is not in favor of a case-by-case. In addition to the inconsistency between regions, we're also quite concerned about time frame of responses. We have several requests that have been outstanding for more than a year on various things that are important to us through the process. The backlog and workload is tremendous, and we can't be waiting a year or two for an answer when it might take 5 or 7 or 10 years to build a transmission upgrade to be compliant with the standard. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Frank. Next, we're going to have a presentation by Tim Jones. Kim is an analyst for the North Carolina Utilities Commission. Tim, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. You know, this is kind of funny because when Ed called me to invite me to do this, I knew I'd been out of touch with the NERC standard setting process. I had no idea how out of touch I was. And I actually saw it as a great opportunity to take a break from working on the North Carolina portfolio standard, which is, in its own special way, is just as arcane and complicated. I just admitted to Ed Ernst here a little while ago that I'm not an engineer, so I am way over my head. But I will try to make a couple observations that might be helpful as you with transmission expertise tackle this issue. And like our FERC colleagues, I don't speak for the North Carolina Commission. Speaking for myself, from my own background, both there, I've been there for 3 years, and then previously with Xcel Energy Northern States Power for 25. The four questions that were posed, frankly, I don't have. I've moved on to the second slide, which just reviews the questions. The only thing that I can really offer in terms of reacting to the questions that might or might not be a help is that, in my experience, transmission companies use this kind of an out, if you will, very, very sparingly. And I do know that the transmission operators that I rubbed shoulders with in previous life would get extremely grumpy with the planners if they ever felt that they had been handed a system to operate that would require them to drop load. That is really not the way they want to spend their days. Ed already shared that Duke Energy is not using FootNote B at all. In preparation, I did call Progress Energy, the other big transmission provider here in North Carolina. Their transmission planner said he thought that they had used it once in the last 10 years or so, but that they never had to actually drop load because of it. So the sense that it is not an out that transmission planners use lightly or use often, I think, is very much the case. And I guess moving on to page 3, it might be helpful to step back and actually do a survey and see how much use of it is out there and whether any customers have ever been impacted or harmed. Moving on to 4, North Carolina, the commission did vote against, in one of the footnote B votes, we did vote negatively. I think it was a proposal that would have totally forbidden loss of non-consequential load due to one contingency. And we provided written comments explaining our negative vote. Basically, our take of it was that the footnote B doesn't speak to the heart of reliability standards, that being to prevent the loss of or damage to the bulk electric system, the cascades, the separation, et cetera, that was talked about earlier. We also feel like, and I'll get into this a little more, that it would cause FERC to perhaps inadvertently encroach on state and local jurisdictional issues, and that we believe that in some very limited situations, transmission planners should be allowed the discretion. And I'll talk about that kind of discretion also. Moving on to the next overhead, we believe the ERO has as its main function to focus on the bulk electric system. And one real observation of the conversation so far today that I find really interesting is that the provision of transmission service has gotten threaded into this dialogue in a really interesting way. And coming from a customer service background, I can very much appreciate that firm transmission service should be firm. I get it. But as I look at the Energy Policy Act, and I haven't studied it thoroughly, but I don't think it talks about firm transmission service. I think it talks about keeping the grid up. I would just maybe ask those speakers who talked about firm transmission service to help me connect the dots, because right now they're not connected for me. Moving on to slide 6 and the question of what is load, I would challenge you all that load is a, and this is even NERC's definition, it is an end-use device or customer. It's not a wholesale customer that, you know, turns around and sells at retail. It is the retail customer. All load is somebody's retail customer. And I think under footnote B, what's envisioned is loss of retail load, not wholesale. Retail. And I believe that load could be downstream from a firm transmission contract, but that load is not the firm transmission customer. Okay? I think that they are two different entities. And that subtle distinction may not matter here, but I think it does, that the entity receiving or purchasing, buying that firm transmission service is not the same entity as the end-use load. Next overhead. Those retail customers have recourse somewhere. In North Carolina, for the investor-owned utilities and the cooperatives, if they are unhappy with service, they can come to the commission. Those who are served by a municipal utility can find their city council people or their local municipal board. I went back, and actually this is on the next slide, looked at the law in North Carolina, and it's pretty bold, actually. Whenever the state commission finds service is inadequate or that additions, extensions, repairs, or improvements ought to be made to the public utilities facilities, the commission shall order that such improvements shall be made. It's not very equivocal. So if under the footnote B scenario, there was a customer or group of customers that complained that they were getting a lot of outages, more than their fair share, and that it was due to lack of investment in the system, the commission has all the tools it needs to address it. What we don't have in North Carolina, and in any state I know of, is the ability to compel those investments by a transmission provider outside of our borders. And that is where we really do rely on NERC and on FERC and on transmission providers themselves and the RTOs and planning authorities. We can't compel the utility in Indiana or Kentucky, you know, or Virginia necessarily to improve their systems. And we're really, that's where we're vulnerable to the cascading type outages, and we really rely on NERC and FERC to do that part of the job because we can't. Moving on to 9. Every electric utility I've been affiliated with has something like this in their service regulations or their charter. This one, I just happened to pull it from Progress Energies because it was easy for me to get a hold of. They state right up front in their service regulations that are filed with the commission, the company does not guarantee continuous service in the event of adverse condition or disturbance on the system of the company or any other system that's directly or indirectly connected with it. The company may interrupt service to customers. So my point is here, there is no retail customer taking service anywhere, so far as I know, that absolutely believes rightly, legally, that they have a right to uninterrupted power. Some parts of the system are so robust that the odds of losing power are pretty minor or very, very small. But the fact is, there is no retail entity that for whom perfect power is guaranteed. Another thought I'd add, getting back to the state commissions and the cities and the co-ops and their authority to compel improvements. In North Carolina, and I don't think we're special in this regard, the commission does participate in the transmission planning process. We attend, three or four meetings a year where the other transmission-dependent utilities are there and certainly quite easily could speak up and suggest improvements to the plan or complain to us. And in the 3 years I've been attending those meetings, I've not heard a single complaint of that nature. Given all that, we really like it when the lights stay on, okay? So it's not our position that such a tool should be used often or lightly. Moving on to 10, then the next slide. This discretion should be used very sparingly. And one subtlety to all of this is that we're talking about one contingent event, not 10 potential first contingency events that would lead to this loss of load. As I understand it, it's one thing going wrong under certain conditions that could lead to the load being lost. It's not 10 different things where if one of them went wrong, the load would be lost. If it were 10 different things, that would be a different risk scenario, and I don't think it would be appropriate to use loss of load. Although our friends out at the Keys might see it differently. So some of the areas or reasons why this discretion might be appropriate, some have already been discussed, but a transmission fix today might be extremely expensive, and there's a better fix coming in a few years anyway. The first contingency event is extremely unlikely to occur at a time when the load would have to be dropped. The transmission operator has the ability to limit the length of time of this load loss or the first contingency event that caused it in the first place. There could be a scenario where the customer has the ability to mitigate the impacts of the outage. Maybe you know they've got a backup generator on site. Maybe you know that they've got other ways of doing demand-side management that allows them to protect themselves from the risk. And then the final, there could be scenarios, and I hate to talk negatively, but with the economic downturn, there could be pockets of load where the supplier has reason to believe or question whether the load is, in fact, permanent. Maybe some industrial pockets where there used to be some real viable customer load there, but there isn't today. And maybe there will and maybe there won't be next year. And where the customer load is not a real critical nature, the other end of the spectrum from a hospital, for example. The transmission operator could be aware, or the planner rather, that the there is generation proposed, even though it's not yet funded, and that that would mitigate these local outage impacts. And again, where this transmission fix is extremely expensive. Then, like our friends in the Keys, I guess, my last bullet, the customers who live in the area are aware of the risk, and they prefer to live with that risk rather than have transmission built. And they may, as a community, have priorities regarding aesthetics, land use, historical, cultural, or environmental significance that are important to them and that outweigh the risk of an outage from time to time. So apologize for not directly answering the four questions, but I hope those thoughts are helpful.
Thank you, Kim. And I want to once again thank all of our speakers for helping frame this issue for us. That to remind folks, the purpose of this discussion is to help the drafting team craft language that meets the FERC order that can be seen as acceptable by the industry through our consensus building process. And, you know, I've reminded the team probably 100 times over the course of the time we've been meeting is we can't have a least common denominator standard. We have to come up with something that we believe as a drafting team is appropriate for the base level. You shall not have less than this level of reliability for the BES. You know, so it should not be the least common denominator. And it's also not best practices. It's not our job as a standard drafting team to set that as everyone has to do it the best way possible because the circumstances in different areas may be different. So, again, I would like to thank our five speakers plus our staff speakers. So I guess there's seven speakers here. And we are now at the Q&A. Section of the questions, and first of all, I want to open it up to the standards drafting team if there are any members who have questions of a particular panelist or that they would like our panelists to provide insight, even if it's not directed to a particular one. If you are a standards drafting team member, please identify yourself and your company affiliation. So, drafting team, do we have any questions? Dana?
Dana Walters with National Grid. Do you want me to go through all of them at one time? Or I'll start with John Bueller. John, you indicated that you supported limited use of loss of load and SPSs, as I understood it. Do you have any concept or that you'd like to share as to how much load and for how long that you might want to, you'd consider something as an interim type of application, if I understood you correctly?
Yeah, I can't say that we have a firm position, but to note that the IRC had supported the standard drafting team's proposal to look at load as the 90th percentile and no greater than 50 megawatts. That's not a hard position, though.
Were you associating any time limit for that, or is that something that could be done indefinitely for a particular case?
A time limit for the application, or I'm not quite sure, what do you mean by time limit?
Well, you had suggested that an SPS was good as an interim measure, but eventually it would be replaced and you get your system upgrades into place. I'm thinking of time measures to how long the SPS would be in service, not how long the load would be out.
That was my clarification. I don't think we don't have a position on time a timeline for that. I think it should need to be a reasonable time in terms of the overall planning period and the specific corrective facilities, if you will, that would be needed. I mean, obviously a 50-mile transmission line, whatever, might take more time to build than the six span reconductoring that was mentioned earlier.
Hey, why don't you go ahead and with one more of your question, then let's see if other drafting team members have questions.
I'll regroup for a minute.
Okay. Other drafting team members, do you have questions? Bob?
I have one, but I think Jonathan just went to take a break. Oh, he's back. I think in one of your comments you mentioned the what problem are we trying to solve? And after hearing a bit of the dialogue in here, I guess I was wanting to hear what your viewpoint is. Are we trying to solve the question, as Ken said, are we dealing with firm transmission service, or are we dealing with the issue of avoiding cascading outages and uncontrolled separation? Because obviously you can get two different solutions to those sorts of problems. And, what do you believe the standard is supposed to be addressing?
Good question. It's a complicated question, too. I think it goes to a lot of standards and a lot of issues beyond footnote B. The definition of reliable operation, it talks in terms of system operating limits and other types of limits, which Bob knows better than me, that could possibly lead to cascading outages or other uncontrolled events. So you can't outlaw cascading outages and make that your ultimate standard. That there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle reliability that can ultimately affect cascading outages. So you got to pierce that apart a bit. And, the details of whether this is going to ultimately lead to, worse things, cascading outages, versus is this something that's just totally local in nature and is never going to have any further impact. And to me, that's more of an engineering call, but that's, that's part of the consideration. I'm not sure. I'm probably dancing around your question and not answering it directly, but that's what comes to mind.
Well, no, I don't think you're dancing, because you're suffering from the same thing we're suffering, is trying to get our hands around this. But typically, the additional loss of load is rarely going to be associated with further jeopardizing the integrity of the grid. Usually, that shedding of the load will only typically make it less probable that you're going to continue a cascading event. That's why, I guess we struggle with the issue of, why reduce the amount of, in effect, firm transmission service you can grant or try and maintain. And, I understand the difference between operating horizon and planning horizon. Operating horizon, because the operators are feeling like they're being told don't shed load, which, further jeopardizes the grid. As planners, we want to keep the power on because, that's how utilities make their money. And we keep our local regulators off our back by giving good quality of service. But it appears that from just an overall reliability point of view, there's no degradation to grid reliability by accepting the premise you're going to have some additional load loss.
Well, the best I can say, I guess, is that might be a reason to have this limited exceptions process. it would allow that type of flexibility without affecting, and it should be limited to situations that's not going to affect bulk electric system reliability.
Bob, would you accept an additional comment? What I was trying to do is to frame the item very carefully, very parse it very, very tight. The example that was given in the Florida Keys, and as the last part of the system, as a fringe area. Certainly the Keys, as you've identified, are what we might call today conditional firm. Certainly the Commission has not argued anything about the radial load being consequential. To a large extent, when 693 was put together, and the NOPA prior to that and the staff assessment prior to that, we kind of parsed out that the footnote B is talking about consequential load. Well, there was no argument by the Commission or the industry that load directly served would be lost. Firm load directly served would be lost. That's part of the discussion I think we've had here that, you know, things happen and that we're not looking for 100% guaranteed power. And it was very clear we could take that off the table for discussion purposes because we all agreed. And then we got to the point of looking at the Commission got to the point of looking at the footnote and said, what else does it mean? And then we started to, if you had a firm service, not conditional firm, not voluntary or demand-side management or other varieties of things that you could pull off, you know, get the load would go away either automatically or through some operator action or whatever that the physical approach might be, because I think we agree something physically has to happen in real time to remove the load or it's going to stay there. That's something that's off the table, that if you're planning, that you plan that you have an agreement with or a contract or whatever approach, whatever market approach you might be using. You know, we're trying to be very, very careful and very parsed, very, very, very tightly talking about firm service to a point. I understand that, you know, reality is the electrons don't really know the difference between a FERC jurisdictional wholesale or a state jurisdictional retail. They're fungible. They move around wherever the physics identifies. We've kind of put a discussion saying at this point up within the system, higher voltage in the system is interstate commerce, FERC jurisdictional, and that to get the power from Kentucky or New York to a given state, you know, that there are some rules that cover that, wholesale transmission, wholesale aspect, a bunch of large activities. And then, but you need to get the power to a certain point. That's wholesale. After that, you know, it's a different jurisdiction. Well, my comment was trying to make very careful is that if you plan to curtail that service, in reality, in the physical world, you only have a couple of really options on how you physically do that. You certainly wouldn't go back and turn the generator off within the bulk system because that will impact a whole lot of things. And the load will keep on flowing. The electrons will keep on flowing. Again, they're fungible. They don't know the difference. What you physically need to do is to curtail, open a device, or remove some load at some point, at that point. That's how you physically implement the curtailment. And I'm not trying to discuss that. I'm trying to discuss the fact that you are curtailing this. And that very, very narrow discussion of firm service. If you have an agreement and it's a, I'm going to use the term conditional firm, is a term that has come up, that the Commission has used in the not-too-distant past, that, you know, you have this service as long as this generator is functional or these sets of generators are functional and this one transmission line that goes from one balancing authority to another balancing authority, and there, you know, from Hydro-Quebec to New York, and there are no other lines involved. You know, I just use that as a possible example. That's conditional. That you've got a different scenario. I think you would agree with me that you would then probably back up those generators with other generators that for redispatch. I think that's the last comment, the last paragraph in this discussion. So you have, from a planner point of view, you have multiple sources, all of which are deliverable, my word now, to the portfolio of generation being delivered to the portfolio of the firm load. You may use a whole bunch of approaches. And we're saying, great, do that. Your only option is not necessarily building transmission. There are many options you have, and all of those should be open to you. The one we're suggesting you not use is the curtailment of that firm transmission service. That help a little bit more, Bob?
Well, I guess the difference is what you appear to be talking about is at the firm transmission service level, and I think this is one of our areas of confusion is just the terminology of firm transmission service, because I think to most planners, when you start talking transmission service, you're talking point-to-point and conditional firm and those sorts of things at a control area or balancing authority to balancing authority area level. And I think what we're talking about is primarily service to local load and not up there at that level. And we would agree, and that's why we put that additional clause in our latest version of the footnote, to make sure that if you're talking about something related to curtailment of firm transmission service where a resource can now no longer move from one balancing authority to another, there needs to be a backup plan there so that you're not going to have to curtail load for that. We agree that's inappropriate. We do believe, I guess we're fixating on that issue more locally of loads and load pockets and things like that, whether there are reasonable times whether you ought to be able to curtail those loads, non-consequential load loss.
And obviously the Commission identified an exception process. And I think everyone I've heard thus far was talking about one would use this curtailment very sparingly for a limited amount of time, or maybe just for a period of time in the planning horizon where you're going from here I am today, something happened, the unit retired or whatever, and I need to build X amount of facilities, and it's going to take me Y amount of time, so I've got a gap in that time frame. It sounds like a perfect candidate for, yep, you can do that for, you know, the N years or whatever the time frame might be involved. What we're trying to very carefully say is that when my discussion here on firm transmission service, the definition doesn't limit it to point-to-point. You know, it talks about a whole bunch of different types of services. And in kind of some of my former lives, network service had to have some transmission associated with it. In retail choice areas, places I still live, you basically have various LSE, load-serving entities, and they procure generation, they procure the transmission to get it to the various nodes that they're providing the service to. Not virtually the same as that slide, the two slides I identified. They get it to the high side of what we might refer to as the local distribution step-down transformer. And voltages will vary depending on where you are in the country. I've seen 230 kV or 138 or 69, or you pick a voltage below that, down to 13 or 4 kV, right down your residential streets outside this building.
If I can jump in, so a lot of very interesting things. I just wanted to kind of get back to one point, which I think might help answer your question and might see whether we're getting some consensus or not or some understanding. It sounds like we're saying that if you have this type of issue going across balancing authorities, then that would not be appropriate use of the footnote B type exception. That's where you would need more a conditional type of firm service or some other fix, physical fix. But when you get into the local area or within a balancing area,
and there's going to be some local load, that would be the appropriate place to apply this footnote B exception process. I think I heard you say that. I thought that's what you were getting at with your question originally, too. Is that, are we all in sync here?
When you use the footnote B, there needs to be transparency so that it's not, you're not using it, you're not necessarily saying, I'm going to sell firm transmission. Customer's going to have expectation A, but they're getting performance, or planning to give them performance B. That it's clear, open, transparent on what's happening.
If I can jump in one more second. I think that gets into the point that the North Carolina Utility Commission is making, that when you're getting down to that level of local load, well, then individual customers have that kind of contractual understanding that you're not going to get perfect service.
Yeah, but that's also, as Bob was saying, why it's good to have the Order 890 planning processes, so it is open and transparent. If you have in your plans that you're going to be dropping some non-consequential load, it's evident to the regulators, it's evident to the affected parties, and so that they have the right to write the protest or express their concerns about it.
Mm-hmm. Be willing to pay for the upgrade.
Right. Or,
Okay, other questions from the SDT? Dana, and say your name again. And each of the respondents, please, we've gotten a thing from the web. They can't see you, so when you respond, please say who you are.
Dana Walters with National Grid. I had asked a question with John with the interim exposure, and I noticed in my notes that Ed Ernst had also commented about being willing to accept some more sort of an interim, and Bob just brought up discussion with using stuff on an interim basis. I'm curious if anybody wanted to comment as well on how much load or how long would they accept that kind of exposure. Also, there's the perspective of if there's no change going on in the system, if the load is not increasing in size, it's exposed, does that affect the result as to how long you'd be interested? Or if you even think we should get into that in this footnote.
Well, this is Frank Gaffney with FMPA. I'll comment on both. We intend to use it permanently. The UVLS system, we intend to use permanently to supply. So we don't intend that as an interim measure. As far as the amount of load that would avoid cascading instability or uncontrolled separation, from a technical point of view, the power system, the bulk electric system, is more resilient to loss of load than loss of generation. So for me, it's kind of obvious that up to the largest generator in the region protects the system from cascading uncontrolled separation or instability. That may not be the threshold, but that, from a technical perspective, is what low loss is acceptable for, at least that much, until you run into a risk of cascading instability uncontrolled separation.
Other questions?
Yes, Shifang.
This is Shifang Thomas from PG&E. I have the question for Frank. I would like you to elaborate a little bit on the not using the footnote B for generator contingency. Are you saying that if you lose a generator in a local area, that the planning standard today, you know, some planning standard would allow for planning for loss of a generator in local area. So are you saying that that this footnote should not apply and therefore you should plan for loss of a generator? Or
well, I like the new standard, TPL, I don't know if you're going to call it version 1 or version 2 now, but you added the P3 contingency to the table, which essentially says the system has to operate like it would with a loss of generator and loss of a transmission line. Loss of generators are, as we know, a 5% forced outage rate is pretty typical. transmission line might only have a 0.5, a 0.05 force outage rate. So it's at least 10 to 100 times more frequent that you're going to lose a generator than a line. I used to be the transmission planning manager for Boston Edison. I know there back in, I hate to admit how long ago that was, but it was a long time ago. Back then, we used to plan for loss of two generators in downtown Boston and still survive a transmission contingency. I'm pretty sure that's pretty common practice. That at least in downtown areas, you can survive at least one, usually two generators without a problem, and I think that's the practice. So for a single loss of only one generator, we shouldn't have to shed load or curtail point to point as a result of that one generator.
And after the next contingency,
in preparation for the second contingency, that's where it gets a little fuzzy. But I would suggest that generator contingencies happen frequently enough that even in preparation for the second, I would be against the use of curtailing point to point or shedding a firm load in preparation for the next contingency.
How about after the next contingency?
I think that's appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask Frank a follow-up on that? Because that first, second generation contingency question kind of falls, as it pertains to firm transmission service, kind of falls over in the MOD standards and as to whether when transmission service providers are making determinations on selling of ATC, whether they should be looking at single generation contingencies and double generator contingencies, because at present, my understanding is you're looking at N-1 transmission contingencies, and typically the generation is kind of I know how MUST operates, is a scaling generation from balancing authority to balancing authority. So I think even under the existing MOD standards, you might not be achieving that goal.
Mike, I used to be a consultant. My experience is that different transmission providers treat that differently. That you're right, more typical practice is to assume a dispatch and then do N-1 on top of that dispatch. Other transmission providers I am aware of also do sensitivities around loss of generator around that to get their TTC values. Single generator out and a single transmission out. Yeah.
Yes, Dana.
Dana Walters, National Grid. Open to anybody who wants to respond in a way, and I'm going to have a hard time articulating the question. I noticed throughout the comments that there was a lot of reference to cost-benefit type of perspective and considerations in all of this. And as a drafting team, we've been told we can't really get into cost and benefit into this situation, and that's why we're trying to define this in terms of parameters. And just open to any ideas that people may have to how to characterize this in a parameter that we can utilize without getting into cost benefit, because it's really not something we're trying to address within the standard as a cost benefit.
This is Frank again. I know I brought that up, but I intend that to be the discretion of the transmission owner or transmission planner, as opposed to something codified in a standard. It's don't take the cost benefit decision away from the transmission planner.
This is John Odom. I've got a question for Chuck Matthews. Chuck, you used a term, improved local. It's a term that I had not heard previously. And one of the things I've learned in my time with this drafting team is that in different parts of the continent, we have some very different languages. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how in BPA, y'all distinguish between the improved local and the bulk electric system?
So, really, the bulk electric system in our case is
serving transfers across the system from generation to load centers or to the interties, mainly 300 kV and above. At points in the system, there's, 500-230 kV transformers, and then those serve the subgrid that's around load service areas in the system. And then the radial and improved is in our system is generally you get down to the 115 and you're serving a radial line out to a customer, or you've got some loop service that's got some customers off of the loop out there. And that's really where we're defining the radial and the improved radial is that service off of the secondary grid.
Thank you. Other questions from the drafting team? This might be a good opportunity to ask any of the panelists or invited speakers, including FERC staff, is we've had a fair amount of discussion this morning. I think it's been useful for the drafting team, but particularly those of you who went early in the presentation, do you have any other thoughts that you would like to add to this debate or questions to help flesh this out a little bit more for us? Because I don't want to, before we go to those on the phone and on the web, I want to make sure that that our speakers get one last chance if they've got anything else they'd like to add. Yes, Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan first with FERC. I have a question for North Carolina Utility Commission. I apologize. I don't remember your name from the earlier slides. But one thing I'm concerned about is that if a NERC standard has this built-in exception for certain load shedding, and that I know currently you're saying that it's not, there's no exception being used in your territory, North Carolina. So let's say that it was, and then it had to be implemented, and then you were getting complaints, you wanted to do something about it, and would the utility be able to come back and say, oh no, we have an exception from NERC and FERC, so this is decided. You can't touch this federal matter. How would this potentially impact the state level?
I guess it's a two-stepper. One, I would look at the outage history in total for that customer. And if it was in the same kind of a reasonable place as for other customers, at the average of a utility, I'd question whether their complaint was legitimate. But second, let's pretend that it was a legitimate complaint, that they were seeing 20 outages a year and the system average was 5. I'm just throwing out numbers. I think that the law, at least in North Carolina, is very clear. These utilities are franchised by the commission, and we've had a statute that says we can order you to make improvements. I'm not an attorney, but I guess I feel like it's about as straightforward a power to order a utility to do something as I've ever seen, I guess. Two uses of the word shall got my attention. So I don't see a federal out as being legitimate, I guess. And I don't think that the federal government has jurisdiction over local service quality. I think the commission clearly does, the state commission.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Okay.
The second point I wanted to make, if it's okay, again, this is Jonathan first from FERC, is that I just wanted to kind of put out there a couple of thoughts about an exceptions process on a case-by-case basis. I haven't heard this morning any presenters that were for it. In the commission's June 11th order, the commission provided clarification that I think was trying to provide some help or some more flexibility and, kind of moved away from a statement about a regional variance to a case-by-case exceptions process. That's in the June 11th order. Nobody sought rehearing of that order. So from my legal point of view, we have a final commission rule on it. And so that would be the process that the commission would expect. Now, in earlier orders, Order 693, the commission made it very clear that, you know, another equally efficient process, you know, or solution to an issue identified the commission is acceptable. But that has to be justified and explained. So it gives me some pause that if people are not going to be able to live with the case-by-case exceptions process. The thing that bothered me the most is when I heard the gentleman from Florida saying, you know, you've been waiting sometimes for up to a year to get some process and to get some approvals. And you know, I don't want to create another case-by-case process with more backups. That's not necessarily our goal here. That does give me some pause. I think the idea, you know, in creating this sort of exception, again, the commission's always concerned about an exception process being taken advantage of, or, you know, the exception swallowing the rule. So to provide some sort of third-party verification, presumably a regional entity, possibly going further up the chain, though, you know, that provides that sort of, you know, assurance that it's, you know, going to be the exception process will be applied in a fair and appropriate way. Now I do hear the downsides to it, as far as, you know, people worried about consistency and backlog. So I can hear both sides to it, but I think we have to put that out there. You know, right now, certainly the expectation based on the commission orders is to have a case by case exception process, and that has to be thought about very carefully. So that's I wanted to put out there.
Herb Treshwin, Vice President, Standards at NERC. Jonathan, I think one of the things that's happening with respect to process and the regulatory process is the time frame is so short for taking exception or asking for clarification or rehearing that the industry isn't having enough time to think about it, and these deadlines are passing without the necessary input to the commission. And I understand the commission has its rules, and people should be reviewing these orders more carefully and thinking through these things within what I think is a 30-day time frame. Is that the time we're looking at here?
That's correct, and that's a statutory deadline.
I understand, and there's concrete port around that, and I think that people in general, you know, when they read an order, they see the depth of these issues, and they need to get their organizations behind them to make these comments. They need to get consensus within the organizations. They need to prepare the pleadings, vet the pleadings, file the pleadings. It's just not happening. The reaction time in the industry is just slower than the requirements, and it is what it is. But that's why you're not hearing what you probably should be hearing more expeditiously.
And Jonathan, this is John Odom. I'm not sure I heard you correctly, but what I thought I heard you say was, since no one filed for rehearing on the June order because of the clarification about the exception, that the commission staff, at least, was expecting the industry to have an expectation process. I'm not able to pull up the order now, but I thought the order said that an exception process was one way of dealing with it, and that's quite a bit different than you now saying that there's an expectation that there would be an exception process.
I had the order with me. I can pull it up, but I didn't recall it being that way, that it's one way to do it. I was saying that, you know, it clarifies that in addition to a regional variance, a case-by-case exception process would be acceptable.
And I think that's pretty – the drafting team at our last meeting decided
that we did not believe an exception process was going to be workable. You know, and as anybody who's ever been to one of our drafting team meetings knows that, or to two of our drafting team meetings, is we often decide things and then come back and revisit them later, which I think is good for the drafting team. But we were definitely going down the path where we were trying to write the appropriate language into the standard so there did not have to be an exception process. If the June order says that there's that we have to develop an exception process, NERC, that's going to be a different tack the drafting team's going to have to take. Other questions from the STT? Chiffon?
Yeah, this is Chiffon Thomas from PG&E. I need some clarification as to what's the difference between a firm transmission service and a firm load. From the discussion, I gather that it seems a firm transmission service is, say, a crossing balancing areas, and a firm load is, and it's not, and it's not within the balancing area. Is that correct, or do I get wrong?
This is Frank from FMP. I'm not sure if you want to meet who we want to answer that, but at least from my perspective as a TDU, network and point-to-point are both firm transmission. So, yes, they're treated differently. Point-to-point between balancing authorities is one type of service, but network service is also a type of firm transmission service. So I don't know if that answers your question, but to me they're both firm transmission service.
Well, what I'm trying to figure out is that if I were to do a study and if it's a firm transmission service, I would make sure that that would be in the case and study as firm and won't be dropped. But then I can, for a load, which is within the balancing authority, then it would be more of a economic situation, whether that would be, you know, wait to see whether that could be dropped or not. However, if it is a firm transmission service, since it's by contract, then it, assuming that the TDU would make an assessment as to whether they would request that transmission service to be firm or not. So it would be inputted as requested. So I see the two different ways of dealing with it, and I wasn't quite sure that if one were equivalent to the other in the studies.
This is Frank again from FMPA. I mean, point to point is different. You're a defined source and sink. Network's a little different. You're a defined sink, but not necessarily a very well defined source. So as far as modeling firm transmission in our mod standards, we do. We model the load, right? So as far as, you know, what meeting the TPL standards as requiring us to model all firm transactions, we do model the load. So as far as accounting for network service, we do account for it differently than we do point-to-point, but we do account for it. Does that answer your question?
Not exactly, but I'll talk to you offline.
Other drafting team comments? Then pretty soon I'd like our questions. Pretty soon I'd like to turn it to anyone else in the room that may have a question or a comment as well. I don't see any red lights coming up from the drafting team. I'm not sure it's because everybody's eating or if we've run out of questions, but anytime anybody in the room has a question, if you'll either raise your hand or turn on your speaker light, I'll try to recognize you. Yes, Kim.
Kim Jones. For those of you who really understand firm transmission service and how the operator goes through their thought process for how to accept a request for firm transmission service, here's my question. Would the existence of an existing footnote B situation that the kind we've been talking about, single contingency loss of non-consequential load, would that today be an appropriate reason to deny a request for firm transmission service? That's just the fact that there is one. Or would the transmission provider be perceived as somehow withholding? Does anybody know?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand. This is Frank from FMPA again. I'm not sure I quite understand the question. First off, usually transmission operators aren't the ones granting the firm transmission. It's usually a transmission provider.
Yeah, I understand. I misspoke. The transmission provider is the one who's making the decision.
Do they account for loss of load in their TTC calculations? They probably do. Does anyone argue with me on that? Okay. And what would probably happen if they did depend on loss of load, this is probably ATC, or available transmission capability, would probably end up being zero at that moment in time because you'd have to shed load to meet your firm commitment. So as far as granting new transmission service, there probably wouldn't be any available. Now, those are lots of probabilities of it. That's a scenario that seems likely.
Yeah, this is John Odom. I wasn't going to answer because I'm not a transmission owner or a transmission service provider, but the way I understood your question, I think, is a matter of non-discriminatory service, is that if I, as a provider, utilize the footnote B exception to provide firm service to my native load customers, I believe that in order for it to be non-discriminatory, that using those same parameters, if you could drop some load and provide that transmission service, that you would be required to do that. And I really said I shouldn't be speaking about this because I'm not one, but that's my understanding, and that's what I want to try to do is frame the issue so that other folks can weigh in whether they believe that that's the same issue.
Bob.
This is Bob Snow, FERC's commission staff. Kim, if you can take a look at the second one line that I had in my presentation, maybe Ed can get that up or John. And I think where we're kind of, to some extent, I was trying to delay some of that discussion. In that, basically, that slide shows a 450-megawatt firm service from the left to the right. And it can be increased to 525 or to some higher value based on how much local load I can drop. John's comment a moment ago was that if this entity, a transmission service, that area, had a different place that dropped 75 megawatts of non-consequential load on a single contingency, I think the comment is on a comparable basis, the entity looking for additional firm service from left to right could at least rely on loss of an equivalent amount, comparable amount, at this location. I think that's where John was coming from, and that's what I was, to some extent, trying to understand. How does this slide has a number of aspects to it, you know, different combinations and variations. And you know, if the discussion is, you know, firm service means for a single contingency, you're not planning to interrupt any of that service, any of them. You know, there's not, in any real system, there's not one firm transmission service discussion. There are many, many firm transmission discussions. Some of them are between balancing authorities, as Siobhan indicated a little while ago. Many of them are within that balancing authority. There might be sourcing of generation within the BA to be delivered within that BA. You know, there's still, you know, there are various varieties of contracts or ways of doing that. The planner needs to understand what's occurring physically and respect all of the contracts, because it's the standards should be independent of the type of market structure that's there. Whatever, doesn't matter. The physics are still the physics. And I think that's where John was getting to, is that from a comparable basis, this is kind of the discussion. And which may be have a little different impact on what Jonathan was getting to be a moment ago on which jurisdictions might be covering.
All right.
Yeah, in the case where
Ray
Kershaw from ITC, I guess I want to ask the panelists that were in favor of more specificity. If a transmission company and a state commission wanted to build a line, how do you prevent an intervener coming in and saying, well, you have a 50-megawatt exception here. Why don't you use that? How do you prevent them from doing that? Because I don't think the SDT, and we don't want that to happen, don't even want them to be able to ask that question.
This is John Bueller from New York ISO. Maybe this is not my thing to comment on, but it seems to me the question is almost the same as what Kim Jones responded to before. You know, is there a federal preemption over something that may be appropriately a state regulatory decision? That's what it sounds like to me anyway.
But let's say even if a commission supported you in building a line, is that good enough in court to prevent an intervener from saying the standard says you can dump 50 megawatts of load and, you know, get an exception? So I would think in court they could use it against you.
Well, I'm way outside. You know, I said I wasn't an attorney. So, but my impression is that, at least in North Carolina, the courts have given the commission a fair amount of leeway to make decisions that are perceived as being in their area of expertise and that have been delegated to them by our General Assembly. So if the commission looked at all the evidence and decided the line was needed and someone attempted to challenge that decision in court on the basis of a federal standard, I think they'd lose. But I'm not an attorney.
Yeah, I guess in a way, I guess that's a problem with getting specific in these footnotes, is that you can inadvertently create a standard. That's been our concern from the beginning, that we'd have to deal with interveners, because in the attempt to make the standard better, we introduce a loophole.
And then, this is John Adam. One of the things that we at the draft teams talked about, and I've heard it at least several times here today, is that what we're trying to define is an exception, and that we shouldn't inadvertently write the standard so that it becomes the rule, because you do have the danger that Ray pointed out, is if it is written like a rule, unless there's some other rule such as a higher regional standard or some other criteria that someone has to follow, you would be open to those challenges. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
Thank you, John. Carter Edge, CERC Reliability Corporation. This question is for Jonathan. What I thought I heard you say in as the drafting team goes off and develops the exception process is that the FERC staff and the commission will be looking at some sort of third-party verification that the exceptions had a basis and were warranted. And you said perhaps this third-party verification would happen at the regional level. My question is, since transmission planning is not a statutory function that's funded under net energy for load, were you referring to the Order 890 regional planning process, or would you look to see this happen under the Section 215 reliability assessment process that is a statutory function for the regions.
This is Jonathan first.
Yeah, clearly it would be under Section 215 as part of the statutory functions for reliability that the regions would potentially receive some sort of submission from an entity seeking to invoke this exception, have an opportunity to review it. There's a number of standards right now that have those types of review or processes for exception. So I don't think that's so unusual. And from the talk I've heard this morning, it sounds like it would be a pretty infrequent, maybe even rare, exception to receive.
Other comments around the room before we open it up to those on the phone and the web? Seeing none, I'll make one announcement before we start going through the comments or the questions and comments we've got from the phone. I do want to encourage those of you that aren't in the room to and those in the room to ask questions, give us your feedback, whether you agree with where the draft team's headed, whether you think we're going off on a wrong angle. The whole purpose of this is try to provide guidance to the drafting team. So we'd like to get that input from y'all. And folks just sitting on the phone and listening, it's valuable for you to hear the debate, but it's more valuable for the drafting teams if you say something. So I want to encourage y'all to say something. The other thing I want to say is we are not taking a lunch break. We are any kind of a break that people here have already had the opportunity to go grab a bite to lunch. So if you're waiting for us to take a lunch break before you step out or a bio break, you're going to be waiting a while. And also I want to explain to the folks here in the room that we're not planning on taking a break. We're planning on just going right on through. And I apologize for those if you missed some pertinent discussions, but we will be posting a transcript of the comments online. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Ed to moderate the next part of this.
Okay, this is Ed Dabrowski from NERC, and like John said, I'll be moderating the Q&A from the remote parts of the world here. And one thing for those of you who are entering questions in the chat log, if you would indicate if there's a specific person that you are addressing your question to, it will help us find the person you want to answer that question. James, are you out there?
I am.
Okay, so now this is time for you to queue up anybody on the phone, too, and let me know if we get any from there.
Thank you. I'll provide the instructions. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. Your line will then be briefly accessed from the conference to obtain information. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering a request. As a reminder, to register by telephone, press 1-4.
Okay, thank you, James. I do have a couple questions queued up here from the presentation time period. And Bob, I think, Bob Snow, this first question is for you from Harvey Zwire. And it was, how does temporary curtailments for load transfers stack up?
I want to make sure I understand the question. I'm assuming from what Harvey's talking about is you had two, let's say you have two transformers feeding one off each line, and there's a either on the high side or the low side, some timers or time delay. One transformer is, line goes out, the transformer's consequential load, because it's directly fed by that. There's some time delay, devices open, and either on the high side or the low side with some logic, the load is reconnected. Is that what Harvey's talking about? You don't know. Let's make that the assumption. So, you know, from the plan, as I said before, the planners identify certain contingencies. And obviously that contingency is a event in time. In real-time operations, there's a continuum of activities that occur. There's an outage, and there's a restoration of that. The planner studies the outage. If there's an automatic reclose, they study that to make sure that there's no adverse impact on the system of whatever the reclose policy, 1, 2, or n number of reclosing shots on the system. Making sure the system, if you in fact have a two-shot reclose approach, the system is stable after the two shots are unsuccessful. And I think the team has gone through some nice clarification in their requirements to identify in the transient area that is a specific requirement, kind of an implied requirement today. But I think Harvey's identifying the line goes out, it stays out. And then there is a, since that load that was lost was consequential load, it's not really a discussion point on this table 1 footnote B. So that it's not, it's not applicable. Now, restoring that consequential load loss, I think, is what he's talking about. He's saying his system or a proposed system is designed such that outage of the consequential load is relatively short because it's automatically reconnected. It's outside this discussion. My personal opinion is that that's probably a good practice, and the standard certainly does not preclude the use of that practice. But it's consequential. It maybe addresses, to some extent, the commission's directive on identifying the maximum amount of and duration of consequential load, but that's a different subject, and let's not necessarily get there. I hope that responds to the question.
Yeah, you can leave your mic on, Bob. This next one came up during your presentation, so I assume it's for you as well. From
Jonathan.
Francesco Elmi says, in the planning mode, in order to avoid load shedding following a single contingency, is curtailment of firm transmission service to another entity allowed, provided that the other entity receiving said firm transmission service would not have to shed its own load as a consequence?
The commission's position is that curtailment of firm transmission service after a single contingency should not be part of your planning process. So I think what I'm hearing the question correctly, there are two firm transmission services, and the question is one a higher priority than the other? And that the commission's position is that firm transmission service should not be planned to be curtailed after a single contingency.
Okay. Same microphone, different person, though, I believe, for this one. From Pamela Mackey, what controls would prevent an RRO from inconsistent application of an exception case-by-case application to registered entities within their jurisdiction? How would FERC ensure fair and just application of a case-by-case exception clause?
Well, certainly, if a exception process provided for commission review that and NERC review probably be part of that, then that would create a consistency across the regions. It sounded like the question was within a region. I would assume that a regional entity would have the same people reviewing and would have some criteria when have consistency within a region. Even without commission review, I'm not sure how excited our commission would be to do that. Maybe they would, I don't know. There's ways that regions communicate.
we have committee, cross-regional committees and such. So I would assume that there's a way to achieve that sort of consistency, but people put their minds to it.
Okay. This appears to be a general question we'll throw out to anybody in the room. Shouldn't footnote, this is from Pat Harrington, I'm sorry. Shouldn't footnote B specify that load shedding must not be needed to maintain the security of the BES? That is, any amount of load can be shed anywhere you like in your system, but that load shedding should not be necessary for acceptable performance of the BES. Anybody want to comment to that? Jonathan?
This is Jonathan first. I think that the type of broad language would make the commission very nervous. I think that's exactly the type of language where you would find the exception swallowing the rule. Now, and I hear the theory behind the question, but again, you need some sort of proper limitations on this, or else the whole planning process can start to dissolve.
Okay, there's a follow-up to this. It says, hence, shouldn't the third bullet of the current proposed footnote aim to require conditions, for example, voltage spikes, sags, swells, frequency deviations, equipment short-term and continuous loadings, etc., on the BES, to remain within acceptable limits without needing to trip, run back, or otherwise reduce or increase load at any point in the entire interconnected system, regardless of the voltage level of the load connection point? Again, it's a general question. If anybody wants to speak up to it, bring the third bullet up.
Who had the bullet? Is that the one?
Huh? Which one? Which slide is it? That one don't help me a whole lot. That one, right there. Okay.
Now the folks on the line can hear it. So the third bullet, and again, this was a proposal that the drafting team was working on. I'm not even sure, did this version actually ever even get posted, Ed?
Isn't this the one that did get posted?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just, we talked about so many different words, I just want to make sure. So this was one that was posted. This was one we balloted for the under 2010.
That is correct.
I didn't make it up. I copied this from the post.
So what was the question again, Ed?
Hence, shouldn't the third bullet of the current proposed footnote aim to require conditions, I won't go through that again, on the BES to remain within acceptable limits without needing to trip, run back, or otherwise reduce or increase load at any point in the entire interconnected system, regardless of the voltage level of the load connection point?
Well, this is Frank from Florida. I'm really turning on dangerous water here because I'm neither a lawyer nor in the regulatory environment, but you know, the standards do apply only to the bulk electric system. That's number one. So voltage level currently is one of the criteria for what defines the bulk electric system. The Federal Power Act does give, this is going back almost to the first part of the question as well, does give FERC the jurisdiction over the three evil things that Bob talked about. And discriminatory practice is one of the conditions in there, and I think we've had a little bit of discussion on that. So you know, we do control things to within limits. We use load shedding sometimes to actually do that. So load shedding isn't the being outside of limits thing. It's the tool that we use to stay within the limits. So I'm hoping that answers part of the question. I hope that addresses most of the issues in the question.
Anybody else? I'll continue on then. This is a third part of the same basic question from Pat Harrington. Limiting load shedding to 50 megawatts should be eliminated. What if shedding at least 45 megawatts were required to prevent a widespread system breakup on the BES? Wouldn't that be clearly unacceptable? The integrity of the BES should not depend on the correct operation of an SPS that sheds 50 megawatts of load.
I guess this is Frank from Florida again. I think there's a little bit of mixing up between operating and planning horizons. I think we've been very careful to talk about what we plan for versus what we operate to. So absolutely, in the operating horizon, we're going to shed load, as much load as we need to maintain the integrity of the bulk electric system. Question is, what do we plan to? How much load do we plan to shed to maintain that integrity? I happen to not like the 50 megawatt either. You know, in all honesty, that's not a technical limit. That's just sort of a, I don't know where the draft team or that number, but it's not, it's just the number. The real number from a technical perspective is more like at least the largest unit in the system, but no one wants to get that big either because that's 1,000 megawatts. So we need to pick a number someplace in the middle if we want to limit this thing. But in my opinion, we can get rid of the number and worry about what we plan to.
This is John. Just to give some indication of how the drafting team came up with the 50 megawatts is that in most areas, the BES is 100 kV and above, and the 50 megawatts was 10% of one of the largest 138 kV lines that people would have, was how we came up with the number 50. It was almost pulled out of the air, but it was we had, you know, some rational basis for why 50 felt right to the drafting team. Dana?
And we augment that with the thought that a lot of the transformers for a step-down power transformer might have in the order of 50 megawatts of load on it, which helped correspond to that number.
All right, I'm going to continue on then. This question is from Dave Hagen, Pacific Core, Salt Lake City. Footnote B is modified to eliminate the option to shed limited non-consequential load on weak load-serving systems for N-1 contingencies. Might not the consequence be that the looped systems are opened and are then operated as a radial line? For example, consider an N-1 contingency of one of the sources to a weak loop system during a peak load condition, which might require shedding a small amount of load to avoid low voltage or overloads on the remaining lines serving the local load area. If the exposure to non-consequential load shedding in this system is only 100 to 200 hours per year, and further, there's no risk to the greater BES, why shouldn't this be acceptable? If the planner has to make a choice between constructing new facilities that might cost tens of millions of dollars for a very low probability event versus just opening the loop, choice is likely to be opening the loop and serving two load from two or more radial lines. Since loop service will provide a higher overall level of reliability than radial, wouldn't elimination of this option potentially result in an unintended degradation of overall reliability to the customer? Further, in both cases, there'd be no impact to the greater BES, since in no case would the effects of the local contingency cascade out of the local area. It is purely a local load service issue.
This is Ed Ernst Duke. I would agree.
And Frank from Florida, that's actually one of the options we had toyed with for the keys, just to open the loop.
Anybody else want to comment on that? Okay.
Herb Frazier and NERC. I think a measure of a good standard in terms of its design is, or regulation, however you want to look at our process here, is that it doesn't create a perverse incentive. And I think the question here points out that possibility. And I think that as we design the response in this drafting team, and as it's considered by the regulators, we have to be careful to not create a perverse incentive that this question indicates could occur. Opening loop systems is not good for reliability. It's not a good approach. We wouldn't want to incentivize that.
This is Chuck from BPA. I agree with Dave's comment, and I think that that's one of the reasons why some of the judgment has been in the criteria in the past is to make those kinds of judgments.
Bob Snow, Commission staff. As I mentioned before, this transmission planning standard has a lot of moving parts, or a lot of aspects to it. We're talking about one of those aspects, one of the directives in 693. As identified in the NERC comments, the staff assessment, they were quotes in my slides, NERC made it clear that operating radio, instead of, you start off usually in an area as load grows, you start radio, you then start loop, and ultimately you might get to network as the load in that area as service provides. Typically, we've all seen that in the planning activity. Commission was trying to identify, understood that footnote B by itself might have perverse responses. That's why there's another directive that talks about what's the maximum amount of consequential load that one should drop and the time frame associated with that. The two taken together were intended to avoid the, as Herb's indicated, perverse result. It's hard to get one directive that does everything to everyone at any time. That's why there's many of them. And but fundamentally, the approach was understanding, there are going to be places we have radial load. There are lots of them. They're typically smaller amounts of load. There aren't too many 1,000-megawatt radial loads that I've seen looking at plans, but maybe there could be. But typically, it's a lot less than that. When you start to get to a reasonable value, I don't know what the number might be, depending on where you are, you'll loop it. You'll do some other things with it, the intent being to provide service. And that's why the commission had the two directives looking at A and B. The team has both directives on their plate.
All right. The next question is from Jason Shook, and this is a general question, not addressed to anybody in particular. As a transmission customer, I am concerned about a TP-TSP using footnote B when planning the system. By mitigating problems via dropping load, the TP-TSP does not have to build additional transmission. However, can't a TP-TSP... a little bug in the system here. I'm reading the question. Somebody else sends a new one in. It goes to his question first. All right, let's try this again. So the TP-TSP does not have to build additional transmission. However, can a TP-TSP choose not to use footnote B when studying long-term transmission service requests? If so, then when a transmission customer requests service, it will be required to fund the additional transmission needed to resolve the problem that the TP-TSP mitigated via note B as part of its planning process. Doesn't this mean that the transmission customer is being held to a higher standard than the TP-TSP?
The This is Frank from Florida. That's the exact discriminatory opportunity for discriminatory practice that I mentioned in my presentation. So I have that same concern. I think footnote B should be addressed to do that. I liked the last version of the footnote B because it basically said if a single tendency occurs, it causes a radial system, then you can do stuff on the radial system. And obviously something like that should not impact the ability to get firm point to point anywhere because it doesn't go anywhere. It's radial.
Okay, moving on then. The next question is from Pat. this is going to be fun. I got to get back to the question now. Pat Harrington, should curtailment of non-consequential load in preparation for the next worst contingency be addressed by footnote B? This doesn't appear to be clear in TPL 1-2. Generation redispatcher, the provision of an SPS, should be implemented for preparing for the next contingency. That is, arming of load shedding is acceptable after a first contingency, but preemptive load curtailment is not acceptable. Silence here is overwhelming.
Well, this is Frank from Florida again. I think I mentioned during the presentation that obviously post-first contingency for generator, I don't think we should allow curtailment of load. In preparation for the next contingency for loss of generator, I don't think we should allow a loss of load. If we have a transmission contingency, then I think it gets fuzzy. I think then it could be, if the first contingency is a transmission contingency, you could conceivably work with your transmission provider and define what level of firmness you want to plan for the second contingency. I would see that as a viable option.
Bob Snow, FERC staff. I think that what the commission identified in this area, I'll make sure I got the question right. You're in the planning mode. You simulate a single contingency. You're within voltage current stability limits, the applicable voltage current stability limits. And let's just, for example, say you're at the short time thermal loading of a line. Just to put some structure around this. You have to be able to readjust the system by generation redispatch or reconfiguration to get the ratings that the loading on that circuit down to normal or no greater than normal. The commission identified that in that reconfiguration, that generation to dispatch, shedding firm load was not one of the items you should be using. So
Could I clarify, Bob? I think the question was, was the standards require us, like the category C3 contingency, you have to prepare for the second contingency within 30 minutes. So I think that was the question. Once you get to within normal, now you have to plan for the next contingency.
Is there any indication? I'm assuming we're talking about category B, because that's the subject of the conference.
Are you talking about something else? TPL 1-2, which is not the subject of this conference, too, so I'm not sure.
And unfortunately, the existing footnote B does have that preparation for the second contingency currently in the footnote. So I think that's why the question was asked.
Okay. But again, I want to make my comment is that in the discussion of B, I think there were three different aspects of the footnote that were discussed in the commission order. We've been talking about one of those aspects at this conference. One of the other aspects uncovered there were preparation for the getting back to normal operation, in my words, preparing for the next contingency, which is what you should be at in normal operation. We're saying the same thing in two different approaches, that shedding load pre-event, not the N-1-1 discussion, but after the single contingency, is not something that should be done either. Another one of the items under that footnote B discussion. Not the subject of this conference, but the question is still a question.
All right. James, do you have anything on the phone?
We do have a question from the phone. The first question comes from the line of Daryl Hansen. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. This is Daryl Hansen. I'm with Otter Tail Power Company. If you could go back to one of the first slides, I think it was slide 4 when Mr. Odom was speaking.
Can you repeat that, Daryl?
Yes, slide 4 when Mr. Odom was speaking at the very beginning. Could you go to that slide, please?
John didn't have any slides.
Okay, then maybe it was FERC staff. It was about the fourth slide of the beginning of the speakers. The first one line that was shown.
Okay, that was Bob Snow. This one.
Yes, that one there. Thank you. My question is related to this. I agree with the presenters who've said that the local load reliability is beyond NERC standards, and my question is related to this. If this bus did not have any breakers on it, the two 230 kV breakers, it seems like the unintended consequence would say that there is no transmission planning violation. And yet when you put the two breakers in there, that creates an unacceptable situation. And so I'm wondering if that's something that is the intent to actually reduce reliability to a customer by forcing less sectionalization on a line.
Bob Snow, Commission staff. As I was trying to identify before, the first one you mentioned, without the breakers, essentially it's a load that's tapped on the line, which is, from my point of view, a variation on radial. Now, radial, if you lose the line, you lose the load. In this case, one radial is there's only one thing at the end of the line, and that's the load. In this one, there's both a through possibility of a through flow as well as a tap load. And that the commission's directive concerning how large a tapped load, how large a radial load one could get to before you needed to go to loop was a different directive that we're not chatting about today. But it impacts the discussion of was the commission's intention of reducing overall increasing the amount of consequential load? No. The commission's intention by its directive was to identify what were reasonable amounts of load that might be at risk consequentially. And then once that amount is increased, allow the transmission planning authority, identify what approach they would use to resolve the problem.
Could I ask a follow-up, please?
Sure.
Yes, related to that answer, and then probably in line with how Mr. Matthews from BPA explained their criteria, it appears like this line, if it was lower than 230 kV, let's say 115 kV, you could call it improved radial, as Mr. Matthews used. And my question would be, what is the difference between not having that line to the left and being radial on this line and having the lines as shown and you have a temporary radial? I'm not clear on why unacceptable voltage at that bus causes any difference to the bulk electric system whether it's full-time radio or temporary radio, with only two breakers to the bus. Thank you.
Bob Snow again, work staff. The current definition on bulk electric system has to some extent a regional basis. Many of the regions in definition basically start facilities 100 kV and above or something in those areas. So I'm not sure I've seen any definition with a discussion of improved radial. Like John, that was a new term to me, and I was happy that when it was kind of described a little more so I understand what it meant. But the standards apply to the bulk electric system. If you're in an area where 230 kV is currently in the bulk electric system today or has been for the last 3 years, then this is the planning activity. If you're in an area with 100 kV and above, then this is part of your planning studies. And once again, the current standard is pretty clear that you're simulating bulk electric system, and there's other definitions of bulk electric system. So I don't think there's an ambiguity. We may not be agreeing that you may not agree that 100 kV is part of the bulk electric system, or maybe differences, but that's a different discussion.
Steve, you wish to reply?
I'd like to ask a question if I could.
Address to this question?
Right here, yeah, on this.
Okay, identify yourself, please.
Steve Rooker from the WEC staff. Bob, I just want to make sure on this example you have up here. I believe what you're saying is that a plan to shed some of that local distribution load down below to prevent an unacceptable voltage up on the 230 is what you guys don't want to see. Is that correct?
Bob Snow, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I just have to comment. That was the shortest, most succinct answer we've gotten from you, Bob, at any time ever.
I'm sorry. I will try to make more than that.
Good question.
Here's a follow-up to Steve.
Bob
Pierce with Duke Energy. I guess my follow-up to Steve's question was, again, you're talking about removal of the distribution load for trying to enhance the voltage at what's a now radial circuit, and I cannot see the connection between that and being concerned about cascading failures or uncontrolled separation or things that actually affect the bulk power system. We're talking about something that's down really distribution level effect, and we're trying to correct that through this process, and it just doesn't seem appropriate. That's where I can't get my hands around.
I think, Bob, we're having a discussion on what is the definition of reliable operation and what are the requirements within the standard. The definition talks about keeping things within voltage, current, and stability limits so that things like the EVIL 3 don't occur. So from a performance point of view, I can look at are we within voltage, current, and stability limits. Standard itself has requirements that the elements of the bulk electric system shall be operated within the defined criteria, which in this case are voltage, current, and stability limits. And in addition, you can have conditions where you're within those limits, but you can have you might have a cascade stability that you didn't understand. So I'm just saying that looking at are we above current voltage or stability limit on a BES element. If we are,